The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to our bank holiday special of The Weekly Connect. This is the programme where you get to talk about the issues that matter to you. And this week we take a look back at some of the stories we've been talking about with you over the past few months. We're going to be hearing from John Allison, who's been telling his story to our own Leanne Coyle about his experience of high flying. Also, we're going to be talking about your opinions on public transport and shared spaces. It's always in the news these days because blind and partially sighted people, well, quite frankly, are unimpressed by them and the council's efforts to stop them. So all that and more coming up on our special bank holiday edition of The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Yes, so welcome along. Great to have your company. Stephen back with you again for another week. And we always welcome your views on any topic. You can get in touch with us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk for taking part in a discussion or having a viewpoint on whatever it may be. You're welcome to have your say. That is what this show is all about. One topic that comes up time and time again on our show and across RNIB Connect Radio and even wider RNIB generally is the topic of shared spaces. It's a big issue, big bone of contention for a lot of blind people out there. And we hear from three of them now. We hear from Ken, Gemma and Sarah on their thoughts on shared spaces, starting with Ken.
So far, I haven't come across that many formal shared spaces, thankfully. But I've been aware of the idea of them for 7 or 8 years, I'd say. And at that, when I first heard about them, I thought, this is silly. And then I heard one or two more stories, and I thought, no, this isn't silly. This is very, very silly. And I've looked into it and researched a little bit and read about it over the different places. And even the guy who first had the idea thinks it's actually quite a silly idea now and wouldn't advocate it in any sense. And the planners who seem to have got hold of the whole idea of it, I'm not quite sure what they think the big benefit is. Because they're not implementing it in the way that was ever intended to be implemented when it was thought maybe it wasn't such a bad idea. So it was meant to be used, what they originally called them was home zones. It was meant to be used around residential areas. And all the major implementations have been city centre, town centre type environments where the weight of traffic is huge. And so the idea of trying to mix pedestrians of any sort with moving vehicles in a busy environment is just, well, doesn't bear thinking about it really, although sadly we have to think about it because it seems to keep happening. More and more areas are putting them in and thinking it's, in some ways, I don't know, I think the idea is that it slows the traffic down, but it doesn't slow it down to the point where it's not going to hurt or cause serious damage. So, I'm clearly not at all convinced.
Okay. Gemma, from your point of view, I mean, you've had experience of this as well. Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, so in Southampton, they have been quite a kind of popular thing in the times of the council kind of bringing them out and not really telling people beforehand what they're going to do, and then they just appear. And so I've had a couple of near misses with my guide dog. One of them was, you know, the screeching brakes type thing. Oh dear, I'm in the road. I didn't think I was in the road. That's not what I said.
What's to that effect, was it?
Yeah.
Your guide dog didn't know where to take you.
So basically my guide dog, this is even worse, but they had implemented a shared street. I didn't know they'd implemented a shared street. And then they had missed off the tactile paving to denote that you were about to hit a junction. Now, so that meant for my guide dog, there was absolutely nothing to tell her to stop. There was no indication that, you know, she thought we were on the pavement. So did I. It was only that, you know, I heard this car screeching towards me, doing a bit of an emergency stop jobby, and then kind of realised, oh, there's no buildings. I've stepped out into the road here. And on talking to the council, that was actually a mistake. They meant to put in the tactile paving there, but there was still no curb or nothing else to indicate. And we're talking sort of one square of tactile paving.
What did you think was tactile? So when you see one square, what kind of tactile?
The bobbly ones.
Uh-huh. Right.
So the bobbly, like you would get for a pedestrian crossing.
Yeah, the ones that mark the edge of the road. You
know, yeah, and so they literally put in one slab. So
that's good of them.
Yeah, guide dogs actually came out after that incident. Cause it was an area I was using a lot at the time. And it took the council ages to put in that one single piece of tactile. So I had to. We had to know that we were going to stop, even if the tactile wasn't there. So we had to use essentially a post. So I had to get my guide dog to take me up to the post, stand there, hold onto the post, take 2 steps forwards, and then I knew I was at where the curb would be. So that was an interesting experience.
So they weren't going to put tactile along the whole length of this shared space. They were just putting a tactile at the point where they thought you ought to be crossing. Is that right?
No. So it would be, you're walking, it basically was a crossroad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Okay.
So you would be walking along and then there would be, as well as shared street kind of on your left shoulder,
mm-hmm.
There would be, you would be walking along and then there would be car traffic coming in front of you to go through the crossroads.
Uh-huh.
So that was the main danger for me, was not stopping for that crossroad.
Mm, okay. Yeah. Let's bring Sarah in on this. Sarah Bryan, who's also got some views on shared spaces. What have you got to say on this?
Well, I've experienced them firsthand because I relocated with my husband last year from a city that didn't have any shared spaces and was really easy to get around up in Sheffield, and we've moved down to Exeter now, and the city centre is mostly shared space and it's a total nightmare. And you know, I've had some mobility input from guide dogs and stuff like that, but I actually don't feel that I'm able to have the same amount of independence and quality of life down here as I did up in Sheffield because of the shared spaces. I have to take enormous details. If I want to go to 2 shops opposite each other, I have to walk all the way back down up to the top of the high street to the one Pelican crossing there is to cross over or get a bit of assistance from the public. I can't even get off the bus at the nearest stop to the place I want to go because there's nowhere to safely cross. So I find I'm having to sort of walk miles to just stay safe. And the first time I got off the bus to practice a route with my guide dog, she took me straight out into the road because she couldn't. Obviously, like Gemma says, the dog doesn't know any different.
Mm-hmm.
There's no demarcations at all, and there's also a real lack of Pelican crossings, full stop in Exeter, until you get quite some way down the high street and onto one of the side streets. So, I'm finding it a nightmare down here, to be honest. And my dog's having to learn to locate posts and bollards. We're having to sort of teach her which bollards to find for when there's a turning, because there's no other way for me to know. Or, for me to give her the next instructions. So a lot more of... And now she takes me up to every single post thinking she's going to get a treat. because there's been no alternative.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. We had Joy Croft from Norwich who got in touch with RNIB to tell us that she felt that she was made to feel unwelcome in her own town centre because of shared spaces. Is that a feeling that resonates with all of you?
Yeah, absolutely. If I was... Yeah, feeling so intimidated that I couldn't find my way safely. I'm a cane user rather than a dog user, and I need the curbs to be able to know where I'm at the edge. And my hometown is quite busy. If they threaten to put to take away the break between the road and the pavement, it's quite a narrow street, and it would be very easy to drift a little bit away from the building edge. And I guess one advantage being a cane user over a dog user is I can tap building edges all the way along to know that I am still far enough away from the cars. But it would really intimidate me quite a lot, and it takes a lot to do that.
So off the back of that, I'm a bit in a bit of a unique position because, as well as being guide dog owner and having a guide dog, I'm also a cane user because I am a part-time electric wheelchair user because I have a physical disability as well.
Right.
And so this area in Southampton, I have basically stopped going there. I don't go there at all. Even if I need to go somewhere along there, I'll take a friend with me, I'll get a cab, I just won't go there because with my cane, they have put in a kind of very, very gentle slope to denote that you're going too far over to the central area where the cars are going to be, but I really struggle to pick it up with a cane. And my cane skills are pretty good, but I really struggle to pick it up because it is so slight. There are a lot of promises made that they were going to add some texture to that, to almost add a bit of a rumble strip so that it would be more tactile for cane users, but that has never happened. And the thing is, if I'm using, you know, my cane, my guide dog, or my wheelchair, one of the issues in Southampton is in this particular area, they put street furniture all the way up to the area, which is designated the road by, like, a visual change in colour. And so to get around the obstacles, you have to just step out. And it's interesting, I did a piece recently with Channel 5, and we did kind of lots of stuff in this area because me and my guide dog had just stopped going there. So we did loads of stuff in this area. My guide dog probably hasn't been there for a couple of years. And in every single test we did, she just stepped out straight into the road, which isn't her fault, you know, and it was kind of what we wanted to show. So, you know, I had people looking out for me, so it's fine. But even when we should have been doing like an off-curb obstacle because the pavement was totally blocked, she was just guiding me around straight into the road. At one point, I tripped over this little kind of dip, which is supposed to denote be kind of a tactile representation that I'm stepping into the road. I just tripped over it and nearly went flying. So it's just like, it's a total fail. And I think it is important to remember that, you know, these issues, like some things can be done that might be a little bit helpful to cane users or whatever. So if I was really searching for it and I thought I knew where it was, I might be able to find that, be able to find that dip with a cane. But if I'm walking, I'm not going to find it until A, I either trip over it, or B, I'm just going to, my feet, the position of my feet, I'm just going to miss the dip altogether and not even notice it.
But that means that you have to be familiar with the route, so you can't go to an unfamiliar place and expect to be able to navigate it to the orientation aid you've got if you're supposed to be searching out for a known dip that marks the edge of the road. So it does really limit you to a very small area that you become familiar with. I'd heard they did an experiment in Edinburgh, similar to what you did with Channel 5, that they took a guide dog user to an area where they had put in shared space, and they asked the guy to walk down the road. And the dogs, sort of, apparently, I gather dogs don't really do facial expressions, but they said if you've ever imagined a dog with a confused look on its face, then this one had it. And eventually, the dog decided that the safest place to take the user was right down the middle of the road, and off they went. And fortunately, so it was a residential area rather than a main central high traffic area, so there was little risk at that point. But the city authorities at that time said, "Oh, right, game over. That's it. We will not put it in shared spaces." So that was 8-9 years ago, and the people who saw that have gone, and new people come in, and it still seems to be threatened constantly. We seem to have to keep having these sort of discussions to say it's not a good thing.
I wouldn't say that it made me feel unwelcome in the city centre, but what I find is that sighted people just don't get the problem. So everyone asks me, oh, how do you like living down here? And they're expecting me to say, I love it and it's beautiful because it's Devon. And I'm saying, actually, I'm finding it really hard work and I can't get about the same as I used to be able to. I just say it's impractical and difficult if you don't drive a car. And they're like, what, you don't like it here? Really? Wow, why not? And you're sort of having to go to the ins and outs because there's hardly any buses. There's no demarcation for bus stops. There's no pelican crossings. It's all shared spaces. It's just and such a contrast from being up in Sheffield where pretty much if I wanted to go to the shop, take the dog to the vet, the doctors, I could do all those things. And down here, I can't do half of them. And part of that may be, you know, time and getting to know a new area. But we've been here a year and a half now, and I've had quite a lot of mobility input and learned quite a bit of town. So, you know, I do think there are going to be lasting problems, and I don't see myself able to be as independent down here as I was used to being, which seems very sad. And it means that I can't enjoy beautiful Devon like everybody else thinks I should be doing. And I'm sure that's true of other people, for other people as well.
Thanks to Sarah speaking there, also Gemma and Ken for sharing their thoughts on shared spaces. If you've got a view on the topic, get in touch. You can email us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Imagine having nothing wrong with your eyes, but not being able to see. Well, that's the experience of Melina Canning, who was left blind after a near-fatal stroke. Melina suffered irreparable damage to her primary visual cortex. That's the part of the brain that processes visual information. But her eyes still functioned, even though she was left with no vision. In the years since her stroke, Melina has gradually developed what experts call a sixth sense, in the form of a condition called blindsight. This allows her to see, in inverted commas, the outline of objects. Scientists say this is a result of the brain trying to repair itself. Well, Melina spoke with RNIB's Simon Polly to learn more about her remarkable story.
To put it mildly, you've had a roller coaster of a journey the last 20 something years, haven't you?
Yes, you could say that. Yes, about 18 years ago it all happened, really, when just suddenly fell ill one evening, and from that point, just changed my life completely.
Tell us what happened, because you ended up in a coma, didn't you?
Yes. Just, like I said, 18 years ago, one weekend, not feeling well. Two or three days before it, to be honest, I just felt as if I was maybe getting the flu. And over two or three days, you know, seeing one doctor, another doctor, going to NHS 24, and then eventually my husband just took me down to the local A&E. At the time, it was Law Hospital in Carluke. And basically, over a weekend, I just fell ill. Thought I was getting the flu, but my breathing was going, and really just ended up having to get into hospital. And they said I was so ill, by the Friday night, they had placed me in an induced coma because I was so ill. My body was shutting down and everything was just practically stopping. So placed me in an induced coma, and basically I was in the coma for 52 days. And while in the coma, that's when I suffered a stroke and woke up 52 days later completely blind after getting into hospital sighted.
That must have been devastating, though, to not even have any warning of this.
No warning at all. So it was absolutely horrible, you know, devastating. And like I said, went in there sighted. Remember being wheeled, and they put me in a wheelchair because I couldn't walk. Remember being wheeled away through to the ward and saying to my mum and my husband, "Oh, I'll be fine, I'll be fine, I'll see you soon, see you soon." And unknown to me, I slept for 52 days and woke up and could not see anything at all. And I just remember shouting for my husband and my mum, saying, you know, I can't see, I can't see, you know, why can't I see? And after that, they just got the doctors involved and they came and explained to me that while in the coma, I had suffered a stroke, which affected my sight and left me blind.
So you've had a stroke, you've lost your eyesight, and you've got a two-year-old and a husband. It must have been so much on top of you at that point.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that actually the first thing I thought of was, you know, when I woke up and realised I couldn't see, my first reaction actually was, how I'm not going to be able to go out and work, because I was a, you know, I worked full time, plus, like you said, you know, in the house here I had Stephanie, who was only 2 years old. But my initial reaction was, I'm not going to be able to work, because I was a medical secretary, I was a typist. So back then, because it was 18 years ago, we didn't have the technology that you've got now of talking computers. I just initially used a manual typewriter and then obviously a word processor, but, you know, it didn't talk to me. So I thought, how am I going to work? So that was my first reaction, actually. And then my next was that, oh, well, you know, I can't see my mum or my husband and I can't see my daughter, and how am I going to manage in the house with a two-year-old and I can't see?
And then adding something else into the mix, something strange happened, didn't it, while you were in hospital?
Yes. I initially, I went into hospital in the February, and like I said, in the stroke for 52 days, and then it was round about, it was the 7th of June, because that's my wedding anniversary. And, you know, I was lying in my, you know, or sitting up in the hospital bed, and a visitor came in and left a gift for my husband and I, and obviously in a gift bag. And initially, I looked to the right to see if, you know, to try to see if I could see where they had placed the bag. And then as I looked away again, I thought, I just saw a bit of colour there. So I looked back, and my husband said to me, he says, what do you keep looking at? And I said, there's something sitting there. I said, I can see the colour green. And they said, no, you know. And so he went away and got the doctors, and they just came back and says, oh, no, it's her imagination. She's been through so much trauma that it's her imagination, you know, playing on her. But I says, no, there's definitely something there sitting, and it's in the colour green. And eventually they told me it was a gift bag. Somebody had brought in a present and sat down, you know, one of these metallic yeah. gift bags, or silver, you know.
Yeah, kind of bright, reflective.
Yes, and from then on, that's when I says, right, I need you to believe me, you know, I need somebody here, I want somebody to test my eyes. And so initially, I actually worked for an ophthalmologist. I was a personal secretary to Dr. Anne Wiley, who, you know, we worked down in Strathclyde Hospital in Motherwell at the time. So they got Dr. Wiley and she came in to see me, and she said, she tested my eyes and she said, I can't detect anything, Milena. There's, you know, nothing wrong with your eyes. And I said, what do you mean there's nothing wrong? I said, I'm blind, you know, I can't see. So from there, I was then, over the months, you know, referred to a neurologist in Glasgow, Professor Gordon Dutton, who since has retired. But as soon as he saw me and he did all his tests, he knew straight away. He said, you have blind sight, or some people call it sight unseen. And it's the part of the brain that, in my stroke, you know, when I had the strokes, it was the part of the brain that was damaged for me to see properly. So they said it was my bottom left and right cortex has been damaged, and the blood supply is not getting through properly. But over the years now, I've started to see some bright colours and just maybe shadows. But, you know, that's really all that I'm seeing.
And am I right in saying that if you have a cup in front of you, you can see, sometimes you can see just the circle and the handle sticking out, but if it's got hot liquid in it, you can see the movement of the steam?
That's right. We've discovered this over the months and years. That's exactly right. You know, my husband... So this is what they're trying to, you know, distinguish why I'm seeing what I'm seeing, but I can't see people's faces. I can't, you know, I wouldn't be able to see you even if you were sitting right next to me. But when my husband first placed the cup down, I could see the steam coming from my coffee cup, and I can, as long as the handle's to the right, I can see the outline of the handle, you know, of your coffee cup sitting there. But I don't get the full picture, You know, I just see the roundness of the top of the cup and the handle and then the steam coming, you know. But
does it tire you out?
Sometimes it does, actually, because to be honest, when I'm sitting here just now talking to you, I've always said I'm just looking straight ahead. I'm sitting here in my living room and I'm just trying to focus and see, you know, things that are round about me. But I've always said to me, if you imagine being underwater, everything that I look at, I don't see properly. I just see an outline and it's as if it's all under the water, just floating there. And I have that constant, as soon as I wake up in the morning to go back to bed at night and close my eyes, that's all I have all day. And some days it can be quite disturbing and quite disorientating, you know, but I've just managed to live with it, to be honest.
And because you're such a miracle of medicine, we could say that, I think, Melina, it's a bit of a voyage, but you've been to Canada as well and had some tests done, haven't you?
Yes, I know. They do say, when you say a miracle, that, I mean, they do say it's just, you know, amazing what I'm seeing, and they still don't know why I'm seeing what I'm seeing. So through once I met Gordon Dutton, he referred me to the neurologist in Canada. It was Professor Mel Goodale and Jody Cullum of the University of Ontario in Canada, you know. And they've done so many tests, MRI scans. It's 5 years since, 4 or 5 years since I've been, but they've been out here at my house to see me and do tests. And they're still amazed. They're still trying to figure out why am I seeing what I'm seeing. I mean, I am blind, but, you know, when I tell them I'm seeing a bit bright colours, I can see the washing machine going round if I stare at it. But if you're sitting right next to me and I try to look at you, you know, I can tell where your eyes are, or if you talk to me, I know your mouth's moving, but I don't get the full picture, I don't get your full face. So they're doing all these tests trying to find out why I'm seeing what I'm seeing, but I can't see you.
It's incredible. Do you know, I was thinking maybe you're developing into a superhero. You never know. How do you see the future, though? What I mean, do you hope to get your sight back, or do you just live with
what
you've got?
I mean, I say I do, obviously. I mean, knowing from what I've been 18 years ago, completely black, to what I've got now and how it's changed. So it's taken 18 years to get to this point. And I think, is it going to take another 18 years? If it could change, I would, you know, if it, I pray every night that, you know, am I going to wake up one day? And, but I know I've always said I never ever expect to see again the way I used to, you know, to be able to drive and to be able to go out there and walk about myself. And but if I could just get a little bit back in one eye in order that I can get about myself, do things myself and see my daughter growing up and, you know, I haven't seen her since she was age 2, so I can't tell you what she looks like, but everybody tells me. But even just to see everybody, all the relatives and, you know. But I say, no one can predict. No one, I just need to wait and see what happens. I mean, but if this is it, this is it. And I can manage around my house with this level of sight I've got, this blind sight I've got. And if that's it, then at the end of the day, I'm here. I should have been dead because I was given the last rites 3 times. But at the end of the day, I'm here and there's a lot more people out there worse off than me.
Does your husband say you're stubborn?
No. No, they do say that I'm a miracle. That's what people say. I don't know how I'm here. But I'm here to tell the tale, and I'll tell it to anyone who wants to listen, because I would love anyone out there that wants to speak to me or try and do more tests, because I say, why am I seeing what I'm seeing? But I can't see you. But I see steam coming from a coffee cup, and I see a washing machine going round, and I see bright colours, but I can't see you if you're sitting next to me. But if anyone out there wants to carry on and do more research, you know, I'm up for it, because I'd like some answers.
Melina Canning speaking to Simon Polly there and telling us her remarkable story.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, we do love getting your thoughts on the programme, and every week we try to get your view on a particular topic that might be doing the rounds. Public transport always comes up because blind and partially sighted people like me and you use public transport so much. Sometimes we do because, well, it might be easy to do in our part of the world, but maybe not so for others. Let's hear what you've been saying about public transport.
I use public transport every day. I work in London, so I commute. I'd say that it's got easier to use public transport independently in London over the past 10 or so years, simply because more forms of it talk. So you have stop announcements on buses. I think all the tube lines talk now, whereas probably about half of them did when I first moved to London about 15 years ago. I've long since abandoned asking bus drivers to tell me where the stops are. Fortunately, the talking announcements by and large render that redundant, particularly when paired with the GPS app, and I abandoned it largely because I've had, you know, some of the experiences that others have had, which is that, you know, people sometimes forget, and so now that buses talk, I'm taking them more often than perhaps I used to. One problem I wish they'd solve in London particularly is that multiple buses tend to stop at a single bus stop, and sometimes they'll stack one behind another, and other than the lead bus, you won't always know what's in behind it. Sometimes the driver of a second or third bus will stop again, but sometimes they'll go barreling past. You know, you can ask, obviously, or get those cards and hold the number up. And sometimes you can use the travel apps to guess whether a bus may or may not be in behind if you sort of look at when they're due to stop. But neither of them are perfect, or none of those are perfect solutions. But it would be good if they sorted that out.
I use a lot of transport here in London, because public transport, that is, because I'm blind, I'm a guide dog user, and as a piano tuner, my job means I have to get to the customers. They can't bring their pianos to me. What I'd like to say is that things have massively improved over the last 30 years, especially on the London Underground. They're much more blind aware, they're much more helpful. I do worry a little bit about sometimes there's not much staff around, or many staff around, but generally when you're travelling the underground, the help is great these days. Not quite so good on the trains. They do their best. But again, this is all reference to London, because London Bridge has been completely rebuilt by stages. So I've never asked for so much help before, because there's no point in training a dog to go from a platform to another platform at London Bridge at the moment, because sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. Bridges disappear, escalators are being put in, so that's just constantly changing. So I'm always try and get help if I can't avoid London Bridge. The other thing is buses. London buses talk. That's fantastic. I will say that the odd bus driver will go past me at the bus stop. I expect they think, well, I didn't put my hand out. We do get request stops still. And they shoot past. Very annoying, but it happens sometimes. And other times, buses turn up and the drivers shout out what numbers they are. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of help and sometimes not help. Also, with public transport now, the apps on the smartphones are great. The London Bus app I use here, and the train times for the trains gives me live updates on all the times. That's really help, and that's sometimes how I know that the bus just went past my bus stop, was the one I was waiting for. A couple of other things, I suppose, not quite so good. The electric, the hybrids, aren't they? Electric diesel buses. They can come and go without me knowing. I've actually missed my bus because I didn't hear it arrive. Because the background traffic noise is very loud. And also, I nearly got caught by one of them coming out of a bus garage because I simply didn't hear it. It was just on the electric as they start to move away, and I didn't hear it coming. A little bit worried about that side of things in years to come. But generally, it's thumbs up for most of the public transport. The technical improvements, you know, like announcements on the buses is great. Even today when I was coming back from Hammersmith, I noticed that they're starting to say what the next station is way before you get to the next underground stop. So you actually hear it announced twice, which is great because the noisy environment. So my experience is getting, has not always been good, but it's got better as a guide dog user, because that's very important. You know, you do need help. You don't want people to be frightened of your dog, and this blindness awareness that they've been obviously training their staff has really sort of paid off. So hats off.
Hi. I use public transport every day. I have to catch two buses into work. I live in Newcastle, Staffordshire, and I actually work in Stoke-on-Trent. So it's a two-bus journey to get into work. And I dread that part. It's worse than going and walking somewhere and actually getting lost. I think that The drivers on the bus are not disability aware. I hate it when you're actually standing at a bus station and perhaps more than one bus may pull up at that stand. And nobody, the driver doesn't, even though they see you with a guide dog, they don't get off the bus and actually say to you, do you want to catch number blah blah bus, so that you can actually say yes or no. So you're there standing hearing the buses approach and thinking to yourself, is this my bus or is it not? Now if you're standing by a post as well, say where rather than a stand, sometimes there's like these posts with the sign above it that says bus stop, and perhaps several buses stop at that stop, again it's the same problem. The drivers will see you at the stop. This is the drivers in Stoke-on-Trent anyway. They will see you at the stop and they won't bother to shout, or not all of them actually, I'm being unfair, but most of them do not stand, do not get off the bus and say, you know, is this your, do you want this bus, to give you the option. So you're standing there feeling very vulnerable at that time, and if it wasn't for the general public actually coming and asking which bus you want and whether you need help, if it wasn't for the general public, I think that my journey would be a hell of a lot harder than it is, and it's hard enough as it is. But I think actually that there should be more focus upon training these bus drivers to look out for what visually impaired people need, and then people like us wouldn't be so dependent upon the general public if the bus drivers were doing their job properly. That's just my opinion.
I think the fact that in this country there are assistance and aid available for those with disabilities and other impairments who wish to travel around is a great thing and should be celebrated. However, the system is far from perfect and does require a lot of improvement. The fact that employee numbers are being cut in London doesn't help those travellers who have a disability and a visual impairment, because most often they are disadvantaged when they are compared with other travellers, because they often have to wait around for assistance. Sometimes communications breakdown leads to no assistance. Also, the fact that many platforms now do not have a tactile line to indicate to someone with a visual impairment that they are approaching the edge of the platform is disappointing. However, I hope that complaints will be taken seriously and campaigners will pick up on these facts and push for further improvements.
That's your thoughts on public transport. You can share your thoughts and more on a wide range of topics. What is it that you want to talk about? Is it how technology has changed your life? How you feel access to reading has been made easier or more difficult by technology or by other services? Tell us your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Now, it may have taken him more than 80 years, but blind man John Allison has finally achieved his lifetime aim of flying high. He spoke to Leanne Coyle.
My name is John Allison. I'm 82. I was born in 1935. I have age-related macular degeneration, and I've had that since 2004. I can see middle distances, but not close to and not very far away, so I find it difficult to cross the road, see traffic far away. I was born in Bradford and I still live in Bradford in West Yorkshire, and I've wanted to fly since I was about 12 years old when I saw an advert in the magazine that said, "Fly with the Royal Air Force," and I thought, what a good idea.
I understand that you did actually apply at that time to be in the Royal Air Force.
Yes, I did try. I joined the Air Cadets, the Air Training Corps, and I didn't get my flying scholarship. I tried to get a flying scholarship. There were 200 of us for two places. And I have a slight disability on my left hand because I broke my arm and I never did the proper exercises. So they rejected me for that. And then when I went in to do national service, I tried to get into air crew. And unfortunately, I was sent home with suspected TB, so that put a stop to that. So I've been wanting to fly for 70 years. Finally, I decided it was about time I got round to it, although I've got AMD and I could not fly on my own. It's difficult to see the instruments on the instrument paddle in front of the aircraft. I could see a little bit of things. I could see the altimeter and I could see whether we were rising or falling.
What is it about flying an aircraft that you really wanted to do?
I wanted to be able to control the aircraft in the air, where in other transport you can go left or right or forward or backwards, but you can't in an aeroplane. It's rather all dimensions, and it's a different view of the world. I think mankind has a privilege to be able to fly, and it's a wonderful feeling. I flew for air experience with the Air Cadets, and I thought it was wonderful, and that made me more determined. When I retired, unfortunately, I could see at that time, but I hadn't got the money, got family needs. Eventually, I decided that it was on my bucket list and I'd do it this year. So I did it. And it's lovely to be able to fly about 1,500 feet above the ground and see things from a different point of view and be able to hold the control stick and turn the aircraft and go up and down. And I didn't land the aircraft and I didn't take off, but I could do everything else, and especially I could do it with an instructor at the side of me, and it just left me to control the aircraft.
It sounds like you had a fantastic time. You wrote an article, didn't you, recently, which is going to be published?
Yes, I've written that article. It's going to be published in the Microlite magazine. I just put my feelings down and I just wrote about the flying and what I saw and where we went. I controlled the aeroplane for about 500 miles.
Really? 500 miles?
Obviously, we took off and Mike, my instructor, controlled the aircraft to take off. And then once we'd got up to about 1,500 feet, he said, "Here you are. Here's the control column. It's all yours." So I controlled the aircraft to go left or right. The first flight I had was just a sort of air experience where I just sat there really as a passenger. And then when we took off the next time, and he said, "Here you are, you take the control column." And I thought, "Oh my goodness, am I going to show myself up and make a fool of myself?" But I grabbed all of the control column. Then I relaxed and I took it a bit easier. And like anything else, it's more when you are relaxed that you do it properly. It's like any other skill. You have to keep practicing and you get better and better at it, and until it becomes sort of automatic and you don't have to think about it.
Are you planning on getting more practice then, John? Are you hoping to get back up in the air?
Well, I'd like to go back and do it. Well, it's a bit expensive and I shall probably have to save up and get some more money.
And, you know, for anyone who's listening and thinking, and probably that would be 99% of people listening will not have flown a light aircraft, would you recommend that they also, if they have the time and the money, would they also try it out?
I would recommend that they had a trial flight at first, because I found out afterwards that my daughter had gone for flying lessons. A brother had bought her a flying lesson, and she went up and she hated every minute, and they had to turn back and land after a very short time. But I think it's such a privilege to be able to fly in the air. I look at birds and think, I wish I could fly like they do.
Incredible to hear John's story, and you can share yours, as I say, by emailing us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. John Allison speaking there to Leanne Coyle on RNIB Connect magazine, which is yet another way to hear stories from people who live with sight loss and read some interesting news and developments that go on in the RNIB Connect community. Now, you might have heard on last week's programme, we talked about the London Marathon. Well, in 2019, you can take part in the London Marathon yet again. Let's hear from some of the runners from this year, 2018, to see what they were saying after they finished the gruelling 26.2-mile race.
Yeah, it's worth doing it. Tough, yes. Especially with the weather being hot and everything, yeah, it's very, very tough. But I'm glad we did it now. Probably worst and best day at the same time, really, yeah.
I'm happiest done, I've got to say. That was hell. Mum's been blind since she was 20, well, partially sighted since she was 21, I think. Don't quote me on that, Mum. So it's just something close to my heart that I wanted to raise money for. I think I'm on 2050 at the moment, but I think there's a few people saying if I finish, there's a few hundred more, so about 2,500 hopefully. And yeah, that's what made me finish, with 11 miles to go.
I'm having my birthday next week, and I thought I want actually that this to be a present to my mom. And I thought, well, my mom is blind, so let's see if there is a charity. And well, there was RNIB, so I was like, this is my charity and it has to be RNIB or it's not gonna work. So she actually said that it was already nice to have people come pick her up, so she knew that I would be free because someone would take care of her. Then also seeing the people that are working for the charity and also feel the atmosphere. And she was like, I'm here for my daughter, but it's also for everyone that's like me. So again, she's just saying thank you, because we've had like an amazing time.
Et merci beaucoup pour tout, c'était magnifique.
I'm shattered, the heat was intense, but it was just a really enjoyable event. So I have a ballot place, and I still chose to run for RNIB because my mother is blind in one eye, and my brother-in-law is blind, and they both use your services. It's a great charity, and they've done a lot for me and my family, and I think it's a great cause.
Oh, give me a high five.
Yeah!
And if you want to be part of the 2019 Team RNIB, then all you have to do is head to rnib.org.uk to learn more about how to do that. Well, that is almost it from me. Thank you so much for being with me this bank holiday. One more story before we go, and of course, it's our Society of the Week. And this week, it's Taffin.
Here
effectively a member-led UK charity whose mission is to allow blind and visually impaired people to communicate with each other using the chat system, as well as all the other backup stuff you'd expect to find on the website, such as training materials, etc. The idea behind that is to help cut down the isolation felt by many blind and VI people. A lot of these people are on their own in their own homes, or maybe don't have access to speak to many people as friends, and find the fact that they can talk to somebody who's in the same boat as they are stimulating and rewarding. I got involved in 2009 basically because I was told about the charity from another member who I met at the time, and I thought, right, okay, I'll give it a go and see what it's like. I really wasn't sure at the time, but I took to it like a duck to water. I found it very interesting that I could speak to all these other people in real-time audio, and that they all knew where I was coming from, that everything about their life was in some way fringed or tempered by the fact that they were visually impaired. I have no sight at all now. I used to have sight. My sight when I was younger was quite good. I had no problem reading books or walking about or anything like that. But nowadays, I have no sight whatsoever. People have RP, which is a degenerative condition. It's given me an outlet to talk to other people about the same sort of problems that I have. Not just talking about the same sort of problems. We don't sit and moan at each other. But because everybody on the site has a visual impairment, that frames the way in which we look at the world and dictates to a certain degree how much freedom we have in that world and how we have to fight and push for certain things and how we have to maybe adapt our behavior in other ways to enjoy things that sighted people do. And therefore, it's been a great help to me because it's allowed me to take part in this charity. It's given me some focus, and because I contribute to the charity through a tech support role, it also means that I'm in touch with the members on a daily basis, helping them out, and that's a very rewarding experience.
Hi, my name's Carl McGee. I'm from County Durham. I'm totally blind. I've been a member for maybe 5 or 6 years. I've just recently joined the Finance and Publicity Committee, and I've started doing radio shows on our online radio station. But I've been a member before that for a long time. And TAFN, obviously the Accessible Friends Network, gives me the opportunity to speak with other people who either have sight loss or have no sight at all, and take part in a lot of games and quizzes and just be sociable really from your own home, knowing that it's comfortable because you don't have to actually go out your house to take part in all these things, you know, so you can just stay in your own environment and where you feel most comfortable. You know that you've got TFN, the palm of your hand sort of thing, is really, really, really good, and it's something that I really like. Because the good thing is that TFN is like not just UK-wide, it's worldwide. We have blind and visually impaired people that have joined from America and Australia, New Zealand, Holland, you know, a lot of different countries. It's like a chat server. We use something called Team Talk, which is a server that you download, and as long as you've got a headset and a microphone, the microphone's attached to the headset, and I can hear people coming through my headset and I can talk back to them using the control key on your computer. We take part in events and games that take place on the Team Talk server. And we also play music. We have like a built-in music player. And again, that's really, really good because you get to share your own sort of taste in music with everybody, you know. I like DJing and I like interviews and chatting on radio and stuff. Well, I found out about TFN having its own licensed radio station. And I just decided that I wanted to join that, and never really looked back since. I do like about 2 or 3 shows a week. And the good thing is that everybody that does a show on there is either visually impaired or totally blind. They do it from the comfort of their own home. We've downloaded a piece of software and we get like a license, which TAFN kindly provide. And that's how we basically connect to a server and do our show that way. And people not only listen, but get in touch via email from all over the world. That's what makes TAFN Radio unique. I've gained a lot of friends and a girlfriend through TFN as well. And that's really, really encouraging. And obviously doing the shows and stuff, that's gained me like confidence speaking on air and working the software, and I've built up my computer skills, and it's good, it's really good.
Go to the TAFN website, which is tafn.org.uk. On that site, there's a very simple sign-up form which has been specially written for people who are visually impaired, so their screen reader will cope with it very well. Simply fill that out and press the send button. At that point, somebody from the organisation will get back to them, either by email or phone or whatever their preferred medium is, and talk them through what to do. The main reason they would probably join, though, is because they wanted to use the chat system, which is called Team Talk, to talk to other members and meet people and broaden their horizons and widen their circle of friends. You need either a PC, an Android device, or an iDevice. You can use any three of those, and each will work equally well. On the tech support side, what I basically do is this. If people have had difficulty after signing up and are finding it hard to get on the website or are finding it hard to configure Team Talk, I will at that point step in and help them, either through a telephone conversation and sort them through the various dialogues and things they need to traverse to get to where they want to be. Most people actually handle it absolutely fine, but there are some people who are slightly technophobic, and those people need that sort of assistance. We have TAFN Radio. I mean, I think it's a standout example of how the playing field can be leveled if you have the right equipment and the right accessible way of doing something. If people want to try it, don't be frightened of giving it a go. Go to the website, hit the contactless link, and even if you're not technologically very adroit, just fill out that little form and send it, or get someone to help you do it in the first instance if you need to, although I don't think you would. And we can have a talk to you, and we can show you how it works, and we can get you on talking to other people. And from there, the rest will flow fairly naturally.
And that's our Society of the Week this week. And if you'd like yours mentioned, then, as I say, the email address is theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter as well, @RNIB Radio. Send in your stories. And that's it for our bank holiday special. Hope you had a nice day, whatever you're doing. And we will catch you again next time, because when it's Monday at 1, it's the Weekly Connect. Thank you so much for being with me, and we'll catch you next time.